Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And welcome to episode 9 of Cannon Fodder.
Yes.
Tonight we will be discussing Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen. But first, Greg, what have you been reading lately, man?
I've been reading a lot of stuff. Now, actually, a weird reading project you may be incredulous about. I read the four Gospels of the Bible this past week in a row. I mean, it's like, you know, the stories were familiar to me, but, you know, just like I never read them all like in a short, confined period. Been reading The Ambassadors, Henry James' novel, later Henry James, and O. Henry's only novel, Cabbages and Kings. You know, ordinarily known for his short stories, but this is kind of like a collage of short stories. Speaking of collages of short stories, similar thing, The Things They Carried, read that too.
Great book.
And I always find with The Things They Carried, I can't really read it over a long period of time. Like, when I sit down and I start reading it, I'm probably going to be done with it in about 24 hours. It just always has that quality for me. I don't know why. But yeah, I've been reading sort of shorter things. I don't know when I read it, but I read, I finally finished reading Dante's The New Life, where he talks about, you know, falling in love and how it changes his life and it realigns his conception of the cosmos and stuff like that. But, yeah, just things here and there besides that. But what about you? What have you been reading?
Well, I've been reading a lot of nerd shit, I'll affectionately call it. At the behest of my good friend Austin Alderman, I restarted the Preacher comic book series. And well on my way to finishing that. I'd read the first 5 out of 9 volumes back in, like, 2004. And then just never got around to finishing it, so I started from the beginning. Reading that. Good stuff.
Yeah,
good stuff.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, I'll loan them to you if you like to get in on it.
All right.
I've also been reading A Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin, which I was kind of in the mood for something that might sink its hooks into me, you know,
right.
some sort of page turner. I've not quite reached that point with it yet, but I'm enjoying it pretty well. I had avoided it for many years because my only exposure to Martin had been in college. I knew this guy who was a huge George R.R. Martin fan and was just an awful person.
And a huge something else, too.
He was a lot of huge things. Yeah, just a pathological liar and a piece of human detritus. So that kind of soured me on the guy. But then I was listening to my favorite podcast, next to Cannon Fodder, Judge John Hodgman. And Hodgman was talking about how he liked the series and the show.
Right.
Like, well, if Hodgman likes it.
Surely.
I got to try it out. So that's what I've been reading.
Yeah.
And, of course, I also read Water for Elephants. So, Greg, what were your expectations going into this book?
I guess this is going to sound... Well, I don't know if I should say that. I guess that my expectations were conventional romance splayed against the background of circus local color. I'd say my expectations were largely met. But, I mean, pretty much, I thought it would be a little bit worse than it was. I thought that it was going to be, like, very, very sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think, perhaps on purpose, she goes out of her way to be grotesque and gruesome and that kind of thing. But we'll get to that. What about you? I mean, I didn't know much about this book going into it. I'd had scattered people recommend it to me, but never, you know, actually sat down and read it.
Yeah, I knew very little going into it. After it was chosen, I looked into it a little bit, you know, read some summaries, and thought, well, this sounds like, as I think you said, you know, The Notebook with circus elements in it.
Mm.
Which didn't really jazz me up too much, because I did not care for The Notebook at all.
Right.
And I'll tell you something about this book, Greg. Let me tell you about this goddamn book. I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I dug it.
Well, you know, at some point, Ben, you had to let me down. You had to betray me with a kiss.
Oh, come on. You know, I think...
Well, we probably should... We should do the summary.
Yeah.
Should get the summary out of the way. All
and
right.
Then a heated debate.
Yeah,
and ending then... in fisticuffs.
Yeah. And then the last episode of Cannon Fodder.
Fuck you, man!
Blam, blam. So, the premise of Water for Elephants is that this guy is in vet school, and his parents are smushed in a car accident, and he's pretty bummed out about that, as you might imagine. And he's just got nothing left for him there, except for a debt, which is an appalling mortgage debt, apparently, which is never addressed again. But anyway, he joins the circus, as many people did in the early 30s, I guess. So he joins the circus, and his main, like, capital with the circus people is that, you know, he's a vet man. He only failed to take his exams, but otherwise, he's a vet man. And lo and behold, there's a fine-looking young lass who happens to ride animals and twirl in the air and do stuff. But oh, trouble appears in the form of, well, her name is Marlena, and her husband, Auguste, I don't know, is just this, well, this cocksucker. But like... A schizophrenic, supposedly, which never really, supposedly he's like a paranoid schizophrenic, which, you know, by all rights, putting him in the middle of a circus is like the worst thing you could possibly do to somebody like that. But it never really comes up beyond just saying that he's really erratic.
Yes.
So like periodically he's really charming and then he's just an asshole. Like he beats Marlena. He threatens people, that kind of thing. But anyway, August and Uncle Al, the shady circus owner, are in a cabal to do various, you know, untoward and unethical things. And it all climaxes with, you know, August and Uncle Al cacking out. Marlena and Jacob, the protagonists, fleeing away to a life of matrimonial bliss. And there's a frame story which pops up periodically, kind of like The Notebook, but a little bit more interspersed. Where, you know, you're actually introduced to Jacob Jankowski.
I think that's right.
You know, some Polish name, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff about Poles in the book. But Jacob is in his 90s in a nursing home. And so everything is about the contrast between feeble Jacob, who, you know, savors things still and still looks at women, still looks at corn on the cob. But he can't have any of that stuff. And then, like, young, hale and hearty Jacob. And, you know, the discrepancy between the two. Which, again, you know, continuity with The Notebook.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, since we're discussing this compared to The Notebook, one of the first things I noticed was that while this book is similar to The Notebook, one of the reasons it worked for me was that virtually every problem I had with The Notebook, Water for Elephants dodged and succeeded at, in my opinion. So, for example, yeah, one of my biggest problems with The Notebook, it was supposed to be set in the 40s, but there was absolutely no detail that made it seem like it was of the 1940s.
Right.
It, you know, there was no, even to the point where I mentioned last time, you know, a car pulls up.
Right.
They don't say, you know, well, it's a 43 Ford. They just say it's a car.
Right.
Water for Elephants is very much of the time. It is clear, and I read additional material to confirm this, confirm my suspicions. Sarah Gruen did a shitload of research about traveling carnivals in the 1930s, and a lot of the stories that are told in Water for Elephants are actual anecdotes that she heard from, you know, elderly carnies.
Right.
It's very well researched.
Yeah.
The characters, you know, in The Notebook, there's not a well-rounded character in the bunch. In Water for Elephants, I felt that a handful of characters were pretty well-developed. Not the protagonist, and not Marlena. But I really liked August.
I thought, the heavy hitters.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, not the main characters in the book. But the some of the supporting characters, August, the lunatic, I thought was a pretty interesting character. My favorite was probably Walter, a.k.a. Kinko, the dwarf clown who was sort of Jacob's best buddy on the circus train. And I think most importantly, there's a plot.
Yeah.
There's not really, I mean, there's kind of a skeleton of a plot in The Notebook, but it's boring.
Right.
It's very boring. And what really surprised me with this book, you know, generally when we have chosen our cannon fodder books, about, you know, 4 or 5 days before we start recording, I'll say, all right, well, I've got this book. If I read 100 pages tonight and 100 pages the next night, you know, I can finish it on time.
Right.
And I stick to that very closely.
Right.
It's like pulling teeth. You know?
Right.
With this book, I read like 60 pages one night, and then the next night I finished it.
Right.
And I stayed up till 5 a.m. reading it.
Right.
It really held my attention. It has a propulsive quality that, you know, I've got to see what happens next. I've got to see how this pans out. Now, I will say I don't see this book being taught in schools 50-100 years from now. You know,
right.
It's not going to be a legendary piece of literature.
Hmm.
But I sort of look at it, well, the copy I had, one of the main quotes on it, praise, what do you call it, when the guy...
Jesus. A blurb?
A blurb, that's the word. One of the main blurb on the cover was from Stephen King, talking about, oh, I love this book, I couldn't put it down.
Hmm.
And... yeah, that's appropriate. I've gone on record my love of Stephen King.
Hmm.
As I've said, I love Cormac McCarthy. I love Melville. But I also love Stephen King.
Hmm.
And there really isn't a Stephen King book I can think of off the top of my head that I would say, like, oh, yeah, well, that's a great piece of literature. What he's very skilled at doing is telling a story in a compelling way.
Hmm.
And I think that is what Sarah Gruen does an excellent job of. I think the story is very well told. It has some flaws that we will address. But on the whole, I was impressed with it, and I think it is deserving of praise.
I would not go as far as that. I'll start from the top with your contentions.
Okay.
The whole thing about, like, the period... Like, the period setting is very, very important to this book.
Yes.
If this book is not believably of the period, then it falls apart. Mm-hmm. Well, there are just some things that Jacob says that made me... that immediately pushed me out of the 30s and put me back in, like, oh, I'm reading someone who researched the 30s. Mm-hmm. For instance, Chicago. City of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Of jazz, gangsters, and speakeasies. Now... if you're casually reading that, you might be like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, 1930s, Chicago, yeah, whatever. But, I mean, it raises the question, when we're 80, mm-hmm. will we sit down to write about Chicago and be like, ah, Chicago, Barack Obama's cradle, City of the Bean, deep dish pizza, the Windy City? I mean, it struck me as canned. Mm-hmm. And there were a few things like that. I mean, and, you know... I guess the thing that bothered me about the anecdotes thing, because she put that in her acknowledgments at the end. You know, she talks about how, like, all the anecdotes, like, basically the most colorful and interesting parts of her story are, you know, ripped from real life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always kind of suspicious of an author that does that or that is too eager to, like, pull the tablecloth off the magician's table. It sort of goes back to a conversation you and I have frequently had about people that love to tell us as you know, like creative fiction writers, like, oh man, you know, truth is always stranger than fiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is always sort of a starting point. You know, the factual reality is always a starting point. Uh-huh. But I mean, you know, this actually comes up in the things they carry, where Tim O'Brien talks about, like, well, yeah, I knew these guys, and this all happened, but the truth of the matter is, I was a young man, and it all happened too frighteningly for me to really remember the faces. But, you know, story truth is better than happening truth any day. Yeah. And I, you know, that's why I kind of tend to be suspicious of historical novels in general. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I will say she doesn't lard it on. She doesn't, you know, say, like, oh, well, he's wearing a particular kind of watch that you could only find at this time. Like, she's pretty good about that. But when it does come, it comes hard, and it bothered me. Especially because, you know, I knew, like, my grandparents were older than most people's grandparents. So they were, like, my age in the 30s. And so, I mean, I knew, like, grown people who were out in the world in the 30s, and they just didn't really talk like this. So, yeah. And I know that's, like, biased and kind of cheap, but, I mean, I'm a reader, so. Yeah.
Well, you know, I will say there are a couple of moments. I think there was a response of whatever that jumped out at me. It's like, well.
Well, he also says when his brain is trying to catch up with events in the 30s, he talks about how he's still trying to process the events, which is kind of contemporary psycho-speak and not really the way that, you know, people have talked since before, like, 1990. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things like that. I mean, I guess that's a scrupulous writer. And maybe the thing that sort of aggravated me about, like, the storytelling component of the Sarah Gruen legend, glurp, is that, you know, on one of the blurbs that I read, it invokes John Irving. And, you know, we've talked actually a little bit about doing a, you know, what's your favorite, like, pop piece of literature? You know, we talked about doing that episode, that special books we like episode.
Yeah.
And were we to do that, I would almost certainly talk about a work of John Irving's. I really, really like John Irving. And he's very uneven, and he's real weird sometimes. He loves wrestling, he loves bears, he loves running, he loves short, dark people having lots of sex. Okay, but I mean, you know, it just, like, the way that he tells a story is very engrossing. His characters are decent without being, like, servile. And there's a quality to his writing that recalls, like, the best of Dickens. Like, not sentimental, like, you know, oh, and then a little orphan died alone in a scary gutter place. But, like, you know, unsentimental Dickens confronting, like, something horrible, like Bleak House Dickens. And I guess that the thing that bothered me about this was that the a lot of the writing gestures, A, were, I thought, kind of conventional. It's like the whole book is written in present tense. And that always bugs me. Because I think it's like it was a creative writing workshop thing sometime in the 90s, where it's like, oh, if you write things in present tense, that's where art happens.
Yeah.
And secondly, well, we can talk more about the style, but that the ending and the resolution to a lot of intractable and weird problems is pretty conventional.
Yes.
You know, like, she, Marlena, is involved in an abusive marriage. I mean, a deeply abusive and conflicted marriage. And Jacob is himself very confused and homeless, and he's an orphan. And he's been exposed to murder and violence on a scale which he's never seen before. And what's the resolution? But, well, they got married and they had kids and everything was fine.
Yeah. Well, the ending is kind of bizarre. Well, I mean, it ends twice in a way. There's the ending of the story from the 30s, and then there's the ending of the present day framework.
Right.
I did not like either one.
No.
Though I may have some theories that make them more palatable. But, you know, I will say, I mean, I did have issues with this book. one issue, much like The Notebook, you have two people who are deeply in love, and there's never really a moment where it is explained why they are so in love.
Yeah.
You don't really get a good idea of who Marlena is. You don't get the impression that Jacob has a good idea of who she is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess you can always say, like, well, it's love at first sight. But even so, you need to do a bit more to indicate that process happening.
Right. I mean, that's leaning on the audience a whole lot. And that was one of the things that bothered me about the style, mm-hmm. is that it is a scrupulously, almost tediously imagistic book. Mm-hmm. Like, at one point, she describes a carny spitting out tobacco cud mm-hmm. as an oyster of dark tobacco juice being emitted from his mouth. And things like that, like, every sentence has, like, a weird simile or a weird image or something like that. And yet, Marlena is scrupulously underwritten.
Yes.
Basically, what you know about Marlena is that she likes sequins, she wears fancy clothes, and her hair is just this side of brown.
Yeah.
Not blonde, just a little bit into the brown. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could describe many women that are very beautiful, but... Mm-hmm. It's hard to know why Marlena in particular is this beautiful.
Yeah, especially when it's established that there's Barbara on board the train.
Well, yeah.
Who's just a stone-cold fox.
Barbara the Breasts,
yeah.
They called her.
Yeah. But yeah, it's funny. I mean, I was reading some of the Amazon reviews. I often find that Amazon one-star reviews tell me far more about whether or not I'll enjoy a book than the five-star reviews. And, you know, there were a lot of complaints about stuff like that. There were a lot of people... Barbara, just the sexual content of the book, the violence of the book, upset a lot of blue hairs, I suppose. All the things that I liked about the book tended to upset people. But I will say, I mean, I guess, you know, the issue of the quality of the book. I've been sort of debating this for, you know, a couple days now since I read it. I guess the question I have, that I put to you, Greg, is, you know, this book, I mean, while I enjoyed my time with it, it's not the sort of thing I normally read.
No.
I don't see myself going out of my way to read more books by Sarah Gruen in the future. You know, I did have problems with it. But at the same time, if I can sit down and read a book that is not about a subject that particularly interests me, and not the sort of thing I would normally be interested in reading, and that, in fact, I'm reading under some duress as our cannon fodder homework assignment. And that book manages to win me over, and I have a good time with it, and get caught up in it, with a few exceptions to having a good time, but generally get caught up in it. Is that not deserving of praise?
Well, you loaded the deck, man. I mean, that, you know.
Well, I loaded the deck by asking a question.
No. It's, you know, like, I mean, if I find out that I'm in love with this girl, and she's beautiful, and it's great, even though it was a blind date, and I didn't really want to go on it, I mean, Greg, isn't she great? I mean, I see what you're saying. Yes, I know what you mean. I mean, look, it's better than other stuff we have read. But I don't want to make that any more than what it is. And that's pretty weak.
Well, I can see that.
I think that the main thing that bugs me about this book is... Well, I mean, in some ways, it is the worst fault of every creative person. Mm-hmm. They like themselves for the reasons that no one else likes them for. Mm-hmm. I think that Sarah Gruen writes this thinking like, oh, you know, love story in the middle of this maelstrom of weird detail. But everybody who reads the book is like, man, that weird detail is pretty neat. You know, like, I mean, Barbara, the we should explain. Barbara is like a burlesque dancer who also entertains multiple Johns in a single night, apparently.
Yeah.
But Barbara, the tremendously breasted call girl, is far more interesting and in many ways far more attractive mm-hmm. than Marlena, the hysterical elephant jumper.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with all the secondary characters. We might call it the Dark Knight problem. Where, you know, I don't really give a shit what Maggie Gyllenhaal's saying to Batman.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see some Joker.
Yeah.
It's the perennial problem of script writing where, like, sometimes you make the heavies or you make the characters so like the characters as in like the sense of character actor, like that kind of thing. You make them so vivid with a few strokes that people are like, oh man, I wish I knew more about them. Like, good God, why do I need to, you know, keep spending time with this guy? That was kind of my feeling.
Yes. I would agree with that. I mean, like I said, I found the secondary characters more interesting and more well-rounded than the main character.
Yeah. They did more unexpected things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I felt far more deeply for Walter the dwarf than I ever did for Jacob or Marlena. And even as much of a horrible person as he is, I thought that August was actually a pretty interesting villain, largely because, you know, you don't necessarily know if he has paranoid schizophrenia. It certainly doesn't seem like it based on the symptoms, but he's alternately a very charming person and a profoundly vicious person. And there's some, you know, he's not just evil for the sake of being evil. It is almost not his fault. And that's sort of the, you know, what Marlena says in a battered wife kind of defense of August, is that, oh, well, this is just him, it's not his fault. I mean, if he has a mental problem, then really it isn't his fault. But that doesn't change the fact that he's a horrible piece of shit to everybody.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's more interesting than just a mustache-twirling, snidely whiplash.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know, you know, and going back, there is the debate, I mean, I said this early on in the episode, I think we were discussing the Da Vinci Code, of like, you know, am I going easier on this book due to some sort of Stockholm syndrome imposed on me by having to read Twilight? You know, do I like this book more because I have so hated the other books we've read?
Hmm.
Or, even worse, do I like this book more because I just have such a low opinion of contemporary fiction in general? Which is probably fairly accurate. Now, I'm not saying that this is a great book, certainly. But I think it is far better than average, particularly when it comes to contemporary fiction.
Yeah. Well, I will say one thing that kind of annoyed me is that, so we've read, let's see, fictional books by female authors. This and Twilight, isn't it? I think that's it. I mean, The Secret, I mean, but it purports to be nonfiction, so there's no point in considering it.
The Notebook was by
an
author. Oh, that's right, Nicholas Sparks. I don't know why I keep making that mistake.
It's strange.
Yeah.
I find that in both these books, I mean, it's not true of all female authors, but, like, a lot of female authors that I have read who write, like, popular fiction, like, really underestimate their heroine. And the heroine in this, as well as the heroine in Twilight, both of them are, like, strikingly not resilient. Well, I guess mm-hmm. 50 Shades of Grey, too. Same thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, oh, I'm a wilting violet. Mm-hmm. Oh, looks like I got drunk and embarrassed myself. Like, everything is about, like, I'm a stupid idiot just running into stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas if you read a book that's like a man writing a love story, inevitably the dude is kind of like a weird, lonely guy. And the woman is always, like, you know, very strong and resilient, and she has inner resources, and there's a lot of respect given to her judgment and stuff like that. I just throw it out there. I don't know what it means. It doesn't mean all that much. I mean, like, you know, there are plenty of female authors that have written strong, resilient, and multi-hued characters. But I just wonder about, you know, the foibles of someone portraying their own sex. Because, like I said, I mean, when men write romance stories, almost inevitably the man is, you know, kind of a goober. You know, just like, I mean, you think about The Notebook. It's like, oh, what's he been doing for 10 years? I'm just sitting.
Yeah.
You know?
That's his dog.
Having to sit. But that actually, this sort of plays into the relationship question. A big thing for me, because I found that the relationship between Marlena and Jacob, it bothered me because I felt like she threw so many things in the reader's path that would have been really intriguing paths to go down, and then scrupulously avoided them in the future. One thing that was kind of striking to me and kind of surrealistic. All right, so August beats the living bejesus out of both Jacob and Marlena. So Marlena moves out of the circus for a while. She stays in a hotel. And Jacob realizes, oh shit, August is going to go find her. So he's got to go check on her. So he shows up at the hotel, and the clerk, like, tries to get in a fight with him, pretty much. Because he thinks that Jacob is August. Because they look like the same guy. Now, that's passed off as, like, oh, they both look beat up. Mm-hmm. But the fact that August is supposed to be, like, a center stage performer, so presumably he's more polished in his demeanor, his dress is different, whereas Jacob is, like, an animal handler, basically, mm-hmm. who sleeps with a masturbating midget and the guy with Jake leg. Mm-hmm. I wondered, like, is she saying, you know, oh, this is a pattern for Marlena. It doesn't really have all that much to do with Jacob. She's just swinging from one rung to another. And she just dropped it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that... there were a few points in the book where I thought, you know, I think this would arguably fall into the same category. So, yeah, this is maybe an interesting and very subtle device that Sarah Gruen is using.
Right.
And then I think, well, am I maybe giving her too much credit?
Hmm.
I'm not sure. Skipping ahead a little bit, you know, I guess we're far enough on. Yeah, I might address the ending.
Hmm.
Well, the very ending of the book, we'll come back to the ending of the 30s portion, but the right. very ending with 90-something Jacob in the nursing home. His family is supposed to be coming to visit him because a circus is in town and he wants to go see the circus.
Right.
And they forget him because they're just hateful people and treat him like shit. And, you know, and Gruen does the impossible job of making you feel bad for a 93-year-old man in a nursing home. That's yeah. that's a real tough nut to crack. So... Jacob ends up, when he realizes his family isn't coming to take him to the circus, he, with great effort, hobbles his way across a parking lot.
Yeah.
Takes him an hour. He gets to the circus, and the ringmaster, the owner, I guess, of the circus, realizes, oh, you know, he starts hearing Jacob telling stories about the Benzini Brothers circus he was with in the 30s. Like, oh, I've heard of you. I've heard about that circus. You have yeah. to talk to me. And at the end of their discussion, Jacob begs the guy, yo, let me join your circus, I'll sell tickets, I'll do whatever, you know, whisk me away.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy agrees to it, which is crazy.
Yes.
I mean, that's just, it's a happy ending, but it's not, you don't come by it honest.
Right.
No one's going to actually do that. You would go to prison.
Well, and also, I mean, just the, you know... This actually is a larger thing, but I mean, in terms of like defining somebody by their, you know, character attributes. I know that the whole point of him leaving his family is like, oh well, I don't recognize them anyway. He talks about how like he knows his mind is going, and he fails to recognize some of his very very young descendants, and so he's like, oh well, you know, they didn't show up this one day for visitation. So I guess it's just Splitsville for me. I find that hard to believe, for one yeah. thing. I mean, old people have whims, too. Let's be mm-hmm. honest. But the whole thing, you can't really be happy about it, because what it says is that Jacob is either crazy or cruel in a way that he hasn't been ever before.
Well, and that's why I wanted to bring that up now. Because that was one of the elements where I wasn't sure if I was giving the author too much credit.
Mm.
Because in the present-day portions of the framework, Jacob talks a lot about how he knows his mind is slipping. Right. He has a hard time remembering things. Details are getting fuzzy. He, you know, when he sees his family, he often can't remember who they are. Details get blurred.
Right.
And so then, you know, with that, that's mentioned so frequently that you begin to wonder at the end, well, is Jacob a reliable narrator?
Right.
Does he actually somehow talk this guy into letting a 93-year-old nursing home escapee join the circus, or is this some sort of delusional, senile man fantasy? And for that matter, how reliable is any of the book? How reliable are his memories? For example... one thing that jumps out, the book opens with a scene from the last, I guess, last chapter, chapter before last, which on a side note is a literary device I always hate. There's this stampede at the circus. The menagerie breaks out, and people are getting trampled. And Jacob sees Marlena swing this steel spike into August's head and kill him. So the rest of the book, you go in thinking, yeah, well, the book will end with Marlena killing her husband.
Right.
And then, when it happens in the novel proper, it's been switched so that Marlena doesn't kill August, but Rosie the elephant, the elephant that Jacob and Marlena both love dearly, and has been horribly abused by August, Rosie swings the metal spike up and kills August.
Right.
And it's never addressed that the story is told two different ways. My immediate thought was it would have been far more interesting if the book had opened with the elephant killing August and then closed with, well, really, Marlena killed him, but we claimed it was the elephant so she wouldn't go to federal prison.
Right.
Then I thought, well, is this just here to indicate some level of narrative dissonance that's actually pretty clever on Sarah Gruen's part about how Jacob is an unreliable narrator? And I don't know, and I keep going back and forth on that.
I think it is, you know, it's meant to reflect his first illusion that Marlene has hit him. And then, you know, like, oh, much as you, the reader, have now come to know Marlena so well that you know she would never do such a thing, which is not true. You don't know that at all.
Yeah.
That, you know, oh, well, obviously it was the elephant. And here's the other thing. So, for one thing, it bothers me that this is a book in which, scrupulously, virtue is rewarded and villainy is punished. Mm-hmm. Continually.
Yeah.
Well, with the exception of the guy with the Jake leg who's thrown off the train, and the dwarf who's thrown off the train. You know, kill off all the interesting characters.
Yeah.
But that the basic thing of the novel, you know, the center beam of the novel around which all other planks are strewn, is the idea that animals have a lot to teach us. And, I mean, basically, I mean, she said that like, it's all about how animals teach us stuff. And that Rosie teaches Jacob about being nice, and, you know, the fucking schnauzer, or, you know, little yappy dog teaches people to be friends. And I mean, like, it's all about how, like, you know, cruelty to animals is bad. And I mean, it just seems like a cheap thing. It's like, you know, like, oh, a novel in which Chechen terrorists hold up a nursery and the babies are sad. Oh, babies have a lot to teach us. I don't know. Like, I just, that bums me out.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't really take that from it.
Yeah. It's supposed to be, I mean, that's why it's, you know, water for elephants. It's water. The whole thing is that, like, do you know how much water it takes to quench an elephant's thirst?
Yeah.
You know, he brings that up in the book about how, like, oh, this guy in the nursing home who claims to have watered the elephants, he's a liar. Because goddamn it, it takes a lot of water to feed an elephant. And the whole thing is about, like, selfless service. And, you know, like, it's like, oh, man, you have to, you know, lower yourself in order to take care of things that are defenseless. And animals are the ultimate emblem of that. She even uses, like, Jesus language about it. She talks about how, like, Jacob is the animal shepherd, and that it's a covenant with his father and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
Well, I mean, I think we can all agree that we should just whip the shit out of animals at every possible opportunity. I mean,
I'm sick of them.
Yeah.
I'm sick of their crap. Yeah. I just mean that it's easy. And one thing, actually, I was thinking about, you know, and I meant to say this during the Notebook podcast, actually, but I wonder how much, you know, I mean, think about, like, the kids in this book. Could you, like, describe any of them, really?
What kids?
Yeah, I mean, you know, supposedly he has five kids with Marlena.
Yeah.
And they all have kids. And then they all have kids.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of it, it's like, is he a great-great-great-grandfather yeah. at this point? You know, these people breed like rabbits, apparently. Half the eastern seaboard is, you know, a Jankowski.
The Methuselahville. And you don't really know much about him. You know that one of the kids' names is Simon. There's one paragraph where she lists all the ailments that the kids have, like his immediate kids. And it was the same thing with The Notebook, where The Notebook, at the end, he doesn't really give a shit about his kids. He mentions their names. He mentions that when his wife dies, that, you know, they all showed up and, like, brought food and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's it. And it made me think about, like, how love stories don't really deal well with, like, the whole, like, happily ever after thing. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do with a marriage. And so love stories inevitably have to be kind of sterile. Mm-hmm. Kids are an inconvenience.
I mean, and that was another of my issues with this book, is why do we even have to have this framework of 90-year-old Jacob?
Right.
You know, I could understand it to a certain grudging degree with The Notebook, because The Notebook is such a flimsy thing anyway that if you winnow anything away from it, it's just a shitty short story. But it particularly did not seem necessary with this book. And the aftermath of the love story cannot be as interesting as the story itself.
Right.
Just as with The Notebook, I thought that the only remotely interesting portions were the, you know, present-day framework. I felt the opposite way with this book. I thought that was the weakest part.
Yeah.
It seemed just totally unnecessary. I would have just been happy with circus times in the 30s.
Yeah, very much so. And that actually is one of the things that another reason that I find the comparison with John Irving particularly inept, is that John Irving is the only person that I have ever read who has written convincingly and at all positively about marital love. About, like, people who love each other and, like, still do terrible things to each other, but are still married and, like, still love each other and still are with each other. And there's kids, and there's problems, and there's this, that, and the other, and, like, really terrible stuff happens. But nonetheless, they're married.
No.
And that Sarah Gruen is no John Irving.
Well,
I'll have you know.
But at the same time, I mean, I feel like that, you know, that's not addressed in this book, but that's also outside the scope of this book.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, sort of like, you know, everybody loves Patton. But, you know, there's a reason that you wouldn't see... Oh, man, this is an awful analogy. I was going to say there's a reason you don't see a double bill of Patton and Patton's Last Days. I think that's what it's called. Have you ever seen that one, Greg?
No.
So there's Patton, right? We all know that.
Yeah.
And there's this... It might have even been a made-for-TV movie with George C. Scott that's like the Patton just sort of lying on in a bed near death and reminiscing about all the cool Patton stuff he did. And it's like, well, there's a reason that wasn't in the first film.
Right.
It is outside the scope. It is unrelated, largely.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, well, in this particular example, not nearly as interesting.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, I mean, I can't really fault her for that.
Yeah. Well, the reason I would fault her for that is that I think that she doesn't know where her interest lies, in the words of Simon and Garfunkel. She stakes her reader's interest entirely on this love story. And I can't believe that these two people were married for 60 years. I'm sorry, I just can't. I think that this woman, from everything that I've heard about her in this book, splits from Jacob within about 6 months. Maybe 3 years. Tops.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, the whole thing about, like, oh, she's just a good person stuck in this bad relationship. I mean, it takes two to get crazy. And I tend to think that Marlena has some weird stuff on her own. And the fact that she just, like, fades into the background. And this person who is volatile and weepy and who, for no provocation whatsoever, whirls around multiple times screaming. I tend to think, you know, maybe not the kind of person that would just quit the life and start raising a family.
Maybe. I mean, at this point, I'm just being a pain in the ass devil's advocate. But maybe she does split with him after 6 months. I mean, there's enough ambiguity with the narrator that maybe their entire marriage is an invention. Maybe the entire book is the dream of an autistic child holding a snow globe. We don't know, Greg. We can't know. All right, maybe too far.
There's no point in writing this thing at all.
No. I don't know. I mean, I cannot argue with your problems with the book. Yeah, you raise good points. Like I said, I have issues with it myself.
I'm not saying it's awful. I'm just saying it's khaki against brown. You know, there's still kinds of brown. I mean, I'm sorry. It's still types of brown. I would use another, phrase. But, really, it's... I think that it is a conventional author who happened into some really interesting material.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And it's great material. It's great mm-hmm. stuff. And I'll give her full credit. She really knows how to tell those nuggets very well. Mm-hmm. The little anecdotes that she throws in. Mm-hmm. It's a tough trick to take something from a newspaper account or for an anecdote in someone else's voice, especially something like that, and transform it into a part of your narrative. That's tough as hell. And she does a good job of that. It's just everything but the set pieces.
Yeah.
So.
No, I would agree with that. Well, would you recommend the book, Greg?
If you like seeing virtue rewarded, yes. If you go into it looking for circus stuff, I think that there are much more efficient ways to find cool circus stuff. I think if you go into it looking for a deep and engrossing love story, I guess that there are people that would find this like a deep and engrossing love story. I did not. I thought that the main reason why the attraction was supposed to be compelling was because she was a married woman. It's like, well, there are a lot of married women you meet in this world. Very few of them do you fall in love with. So, I would recommend it with reservations. It's not a bad beach read, that kind of thing. But,
Yeah, I would, similarly, I would recommend this book. If you were looking for something that, if you think you would be interested in the subject, and you are looking for something that is entertaining and that is enough for you,
yeah,
I would recommend it without hesitation. So I guess we don't really have to do the what would you recommend instead portion. We can if you want to. I don't have anything cooked up, but.
Oh, really? Well, there's a Bruce Springsteen song. Off the Wild, the Innocent, and the Street Show. Called Wild Billy Circus Story, that I like better than this book. As I may have indicated earlier in the podcast, I like a lot of John Irving better than this book. John Irving, I will say, I really like John Irving, and a lot of his stuff is pretty cool. And it gets real weird. Like, the Hotel New Hampshire has some really cool parts in it. There's this crazy alienated woman who dresses up in a bear costume and just, like, stalks around throughout the book and things like that. It's better than that. I know that sounds just, like, really shitty, but, like, it's...
Sounds awesome.
But it gets better.
What about her extended family? That's what I want to know about. But, what are her grandkids like? I'm sorry, Greg. I don't know why I'm being such an asshole.
I really like John Irving. I think John Irving is a better exemplar of the Nouveau Dickens school of writing. Mm-hmm. And I think it does deserve pointing out that for far too long, people have been trying to write just experimental stuff. And people who don't write experimental stuff feel bad about not writing experimental stuff. It's like, I don't write that highbrow stuff, so I guess I should just stop. None of my stories involve a checkerboard on the page with words in it. Like, that kind of thing. And, like, not every story needs to be that way. And, in fact, if you don't have a vibrant storytelling readership of people that just, like, read stories, then there's not really much point in having experimental literature. It's not really experimental anymore. Good on her. I think that there are slightly better exemplars of what she's doing. That's all I'd say.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I will say, while I don't have a recommendation, for something, for this book, I will say that going back to the notebook episode, I would recommend this instead of the notebook. by a country mile.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that this probably, if you think you would like The Notebook, this will do a much better job of scratching that particular itch.
Yeah.
That's far more interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you the next book we're going to read.
Yeah, I guess you got to recommend something.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, you know, this episode, probably not as funny as other episodes, because we're...
It's a laugh riot, man. What are you talking about?
Not so much seething hatred. Hmm. So I thought, well, you know...
Except for Greg.
Well, for me. well, I better pick a book that we will just have a field day with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I have chosen 23 Minutes in Hell. Which is a story of a man whose name I
reading
cannot
letter
write down.
For Anyway.
Ho, ho, ho.
I'm sorry, I'm just giving you shit. Anyway, a man who...
spends 23 minutes in hell. He lies down to take a nap and somehow falls into hell, apparently.
Whoops.
He's there for 23 minutes, and then he talks about it, and I hear it was bad. I hear it was really just no fun at all.
Being in hell or the book?
Well, hell. I mean, word on the street. Rough stuff. Real tough times. So that will be the next episode.
Okay.
23 All right. Minutes in Hell.
All right.
I wish I'd written down the author's name.
Well...
Some jerk.
Yeah, his oeuvre is massive, obviously.
So, as always, encourage you to send us an email.
Yeah.
CannonFodderPod@gmail.com. We would really love to hear from you. Send us recommendations for books we can do in the future, and yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
You can follow me at Ben R. Williams. Mm-hmm. You can occasionally follow Greg at Old Jawbone on Twitter.
Yeah.
This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You can go to my website, BenRWilliams.com. And as always, I want to thank Mr. Ryan Browning, our dear friend, for the use of his song Destroyer that bookends the podcast. And you can download that song and all kinds of other great songs out of the Roanoke, Virginia area at SewnTogetherRecords.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, check that out. And until next time, good night.
Good night, everyone.